Always a pleasure to have the privilege of studying a little Torah with all of you this evening. Today on the Jewish calendar, it was the 19th of Kislev, and I just noticed this ad in one of the local newspapers, so I included it on your source sheet so that we could use it as a jumping off point. It's an ad for a Siyum HaShas and a Hakel concert and a Fabrengen. And there are a lot of terms here that seem to be known to insiders. If you look at the top, so it says it's Rosh Hashanah LeChasidus. It's the Rosh Hashanah of Hasidism. 19th of Kislev, celebrate the Chag HaGeula. So the holiday of redemption of the 19th of Kislev. So to the uninitiated, we have to wonder just what it is that we're meant to be celebrating on this day. I don't know, the kids had a regular school day. No one came home talking about the holiday of Yud Tes Kislev. I guess it depends where you send your kids to school. But the kind of provocative question that I wanted to begin with is what is the significance of this special day? So in the course of our session tonight, hopefully we'll answer some of these questions. Let me just say a word or two by way of introduction. Over the past number of weeks, I've sometimes lamented that there are not any meaningful or not any decent biographies of some of the characters that we talked about. So you can't really find an academic biography of the Shach or the Taz or the Magen Avraham. When it comes to our subject tonight, there is, in fact, an excellent biography. It doesn't focus at all on the halachic contributions of Shneur Zalman of Liadi, but the excellent biography that I'm referring to is the biography written by Emmanuel Etkus. It's called Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, The Origins of Chabad Hasidism, and it's available on Amazon. It's available in the library. It was written in Hebrew originally, but it's been translated. Emmanuel Etkus is one of the greatest living scholars of 18th century Jewish history. I had the personal privilege of studying with him when he was a visiting professor at Yeshiva University a number of years ago. He wrote the biography of the Vilna Gaon, he wrote the biography of the Baal Shem Tov, and he wrote this biography of Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. So I'd say the first half of tonight's session draws heavily on the scholarship of Professor Etkus. The parts I get right, I attribute to him, and everything else I can take credit for. Let me add just one final introductory note, and then I want to begin to talk about Reb Shneur Zalman and the origins of Hasidism and Chabad. So, you know, if you opened up a Shulchan Aruch and you just started learning some of the halachos, and someone stopped you and said, "Oh, but do you know the history of the Magen Avraham and who that was, and the history of the Taz?" And so, you know, sometimes those things, the biography and the history and historical context, really matter. And sometimes, you know, you could be just fine without the historical context. You know, we're trying to figure out if you didn't light you know, if you didn't light candles on the first night of Chanukah, and now you're lighting candles on the second night of Chanukah, should you say a Shehecheyanu? So you look up the halacha and, you know, does it matter if the person who authored the opinion lived in 16th century Tzfat or 18th century Poland? Maybe, but it's at the end of the day an intellectual argument, and you can understand the different positions, and you look for the best argument. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes you could say, you know, history is nice to know, but it's dispensable. In the case of Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, I want to argue that historical context is entirely indispensable. You can't understand the man or his writings or his teachings without understanding who he was, what he was trying to accomplish, what his goals were, what animated him, and what it was he was doing when he wrote the books that he left behind and the texts that we read. Okay, so who was Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, sometimes known as the Baal HaTanya, sometimes known as the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, sometimes known as the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and that's kind of our segue this evening. This has been a course about Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Shulchan Aruch and the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch. And this man, as we'll learn in a few moments, wrote a book called the Shulchan Aruch Haref. So who was this man, and what can we learn about the origins of Chabad and the origins of Chassidus in the process? Okay, so this is obviously a big topic, and I just want to say a couple words to set the stage and put things in context. As you know, the Baal Shem Tov is generally considered to be the founder of Hasidism. He's born in or around 1698, and he dies in 1760. So the center of our story is going to be the second half of the 18th century. Hasidism, as you know, taught that God is immanent, everyone can be close to Hashem. Torah, in the study of Torah, is not the only path to get close to Hashem. There's an emphasis on tefillah, there's an emphasis on simcha. There's a Rebbe who can guide you, and mysticism and reliance on mystical texts are very important in the Hasidic world. Okay, so the Baal Shem Tov decided in about 1740 to expound his teachings in the shtetl of Mezhibuzh, and he attracts a number of students to his court. Among the most prominent, some of these names will be familiar to you, among the most prominent students are Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy, Meir Margolius of Ostrog, Menachem Mendel of Bar, Dov Ber of Mezrich, and Aryeh Leib of Polnoy. So Dov Ber of Mezrich becomes one of the leaders of the inchoate Hasidic movement in the aftermath of the death of the Baal Shem Tov in 1760. Okay, so we consider that like the second generation of Hasidism. And Reb Shneur Zalman, who's born in 1745, at around the age of 20, becomes interested in Hasidism, and travels from his birthplace in Liozno, which is in contemporary Belarus. He travels to Mezrich, to the base medrash of Rav Dov Ber. Okay, Dov Ber, one of the principal students of the Baal Shem Tov, and a young Shneur Zalman becomes attracted to the teachings of Dov Ber, and begins learning Hasidism and Kabbalah with his teacher. He studies with him for a number of years. After the Magid's death, okay, remember the Baal Shem Tov died in 1760. The Magid of Mezrich becomes his heir for around the next decade, but he only lives until 1772. Upon his passing, Reb Shneur Zalman, along with Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, become essentially the heirs to the Hasidic movement. Okay, so they are the kind of heads of this fledgling movement of Hasidism. So, as you know, the Vilna Gaon led the opposition against Hasidism. The Vilna Gaon was the undisputed Gadol Hador. He held no official position. He was not the rabbi of a shul. He was not the head of a Beis Medrash. He was not an Av Beis Din. He was just the Vilna Gaon. And everyone knew that he was the greatest rabbinic mind and greatest rabbinic figure of his generation. No questions asked, no debate about this issue. Okay. He lives, just to put things in perspective, until 1797. So the Vilna Gaon is not happy about Hasidism. He's in Vilna. He's in, you know, present day Vilnius, present day Lithuania. And Hasidism is starting to take a foothold. He gets wind of what's happening, some of the changes afoot. The Hasidim are doing things in davening that we don't do, certain movements and gesticulations, and they've changed the nusach of davening, and they do shechita in a different way, and they're not careful about the times of davening. And he wants none of it, and he says this is deeply problematic. The back of his mind may be Sabbatianism and Frankism and the sense that we cannot abide the promotion or the acceptance of a new sectarian movement. We have to nip this in the bud. And he says, no, no Hasidism. Okay, these guys are beyond the pale. We don't accept them, and they have no business, being in our community. So in 1772, Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk and Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi make a trip, and they decide they're going to visit the Vilna Gaon. They're going to meet with him, and they're going to try to persuade him. They're going to try to persuade him that really Hasidism is not sectarian. It's not so different than it's traditional, and you should be on our side. We're all on the same team. We can drink a l'chaim together. Now, just to zoom out for a second, some of the challenges that I've expressed in the course of the past weeks is, how much information do we have about the Shach? I shared, we had like one letter from the Shach. And so it's fascinating to read the one letter that survives. When it comes to Shneur Zalman of Liadi, we have troves and troves of documents, books that he wrote, letters that he wrote, letters that people wrote that wrote to him, reports of people who had come to meet with him. And you have to remember, right, he's a Hasidic Rebbe. So if somebody ever got a birthday card from their Hasidic Rebbe, so they didn't throw it in the trash the day after the birthday was over. They put a frame around it, and they put it in a lockbox, and they told their children all about where the key is to the lockbox. I'm exaggerating here, but just a little to make the point that in the case of a Hasidic Rebbe, because there was this special relationship between the Rebbe and the Hasidim, there was an extra effort to preserve and maintain, anything that had to do with the Rebbe. So we have all kinds of firsthand and secondhand documentation with respect to Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Here is an example, a letter that he wrote with his reflections. This is like 25 years after the fact, but he tells the story of how he took a trip to meet the Vilna Gaon. It's unbelievable. And he writes the following. You have it in source number one. He says, We went to meet the Vilna Gaon. The idea was to chat with him, to talk with him, and to try to disabuse him of any false ideas he has about our movement. Mendel, this is Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk. And what happened? We got to his house, the Sagar Hadeles Ba'adenu Pamayim. We knocked on the door, and he closed the door twice. We asked if we could meet with him, and he said no. V'chasher dibru lo gdolei ha'ir. Rabbeinu, hinei zeh harav him shalahem bali svakeach im kvod toras Rabbeinu. V'chasher yinritzach bevada hinei bazeh yeshalom al Yisrael. Dacha osan b'dichuyim. We tried to convince the rabbi of the city. We said we could arrange the meeting and we could just meet with him. Shalom al Yisrael, we'll make peace. V'chasher echulav tzirbo me'od chalaf elachlo v'nasa min ha'ir. V'shasham ad yom nisiyaseinu me'ir ki yadua lezikne iram. And you know what happened? We tried to get a meeting with him. So you know what the Vilna Gaon did? He left town. He left town until he heard that we weren't there anymore, and then he went back home. Okay, he said, I'm not talking to you. You're beyond the pale, and I'm not taking the meeting. And again, this is not an apocryphal story. We have the firsthand account from Reb Shneur Zalman himself. Okay, and he only stands to lose by sharing the fact that the Vilna Gaon was so unwilling to meet with him. The aftermath, and this continues in the source if you're interested, he says, as long as we were in the neighborhood, we went to the neighboring town of Shklov to set up some kind of a disputation or some kind of public debate where we could answer publicly questions that the Misnagdim, our opponents, had about Hasidism. And somehow we had this discussion, we had this debate, it went absolutely nowhere, we accomplished nothing, and we got ridden out of town. So following the following that debate, the leaders of Shklov went back to the Vilna Gaon and said, you know, you wouldn't meet with this this Hasidic guy, but we did, and we talked to him, and we confirm what you suspected. And at that point, there was an organized and systemic campaign launched against Hasidism. There's some debate among the scholars whether and to what extent it was launched by the Vilna Gaon, but it was certainly launched with his approval, and things continued to escalate from there. I'll just say a note, and Emmanuel Ekkis is very careful to point this out. He said, you know, Schneer Zalman was in charge of the Hasidic response to the persecution at the hands of the Misnagdim. And his main teaching with respect to how to respond was restraint. He said, you know, they're going to egg you on, and just don't take the bait, and we don't need to fight with them. We should feel the correctness of our convictions, and we should plow along, believing that that we're right, and one day our opponents will come to their will come to their senses. Emmanuel Edkus actually makes a fascinating observation. It's a very important question, and I don't know anyone else who asked it. He said, you have to put yourself in the mind and the hearts of the Hasidim living at the end of the 18th century. And you wake up every day knowing that the undisputed Gadol Hador thinks you are a sectarian. So what do you tell yourself, right? When you have that thought, you're like, everyone respects his opinion, and everyone has to live with his position and his opinion. We're living in a way that he has deemed contrary to normative Judaism. So, well, what do you tell yourself when that thought goes through your head? Like, he didn't say it, he didn't mean it. No, he said it, and he meant it. So Emmanuel Edkis said that there's a few explanations, there are a few ways to think about this question, but perhaps the most compelling is that the Hasidim told themselves the Gaon said it, and the Vilna Gaon said it, and the Vilna Gaon meant it, but his position was predicated on false information. Okay, so he was misled, and we had no way of ever disabusing him of what misled him, so he reached a conclusion that's actually not right. And if you don't say that, then you're really in a trap, because if you believe that the Vilna Gaon is the Gadol Hador, and he paskened against you, so how could you not kind of come back into line? So they had to tell themselves some kind of story about how the Vilna Gaon had been misled. Okay, let me say a couple more words about Schneer Zalman's biography, and then we'll pause for a moment to ask if there are any questions or comments. So throughout this time, the 1770s, 1780s, 1790s, Reb Schneur Zalman sets up a Hasidic court, and he attracts hundreds and then thousands of Hasidim who come to his Hasidic court. He has a reputation for being a spellbinding orator and this charismatic speaker. The sermon becomes a very important component of his pedagogy and his teaching. And there's another institution which he popularizes, colloquially called Yechidus. You have Yechidus with the Rebbe. What's the Yechidus with the Rebbe? It means that you have a personal audience with the Rebbe, where you can pour out your heart and talk to him, and he'll spend, you know, not 2 minutes, but he'll spend real time with you to guide you in the ways of mysticism and Hasidism, and to set you on the path. I'll just say a note, which I'll hopefully we'll circle back to later. So he's inundated by these Hasidim coming from all over to hear his words of Torah and to learn from him and to seek his guidance. And as a general rule, he always privileges the new Hasidim, people he's never met before, over kind of the local community. And again, I'll circle back to this because he's very interested in the kind of expansion of this, let's just call it an empire, right? The Hasidic teachings that he is propagating should spread to all the regions and all the provinces of the Pale of Settlement throughout the Jewish community. And the way to do that is to connect with as many people as possible, and to connect with people who are coming from far away places. In addition, he took a great interest in the dispersed Belarusian Jewish communities throughout the Pale of Settlement, and he had, close connections with those communities as satellites. Again, kind of thinking about how to expand the reach of his teachings and the Hasidic movement. 1797, a conflict broke out between Shneur Zalman and a man called Rav Avraham of Kalisk. It was kind of a turf war, and it's not our topic for tonight, but I just want to put this in front of you to let you know that it wasn't all rosy. And again, I'll come back to this in a second. Even internally within the Hasidic community, there were kind of these internecine fights and disputes over all the kinds of things that one would expect to see people fighting about, as far as where funds go and who has the authority and those kinds of questions. In 1798, this is now the year after the Vilna Gaon has passed away. In 1798, things go south. Okay, for Rav Shneur Zalman, his enemies, and he has many. His enemies report to the czarist government that he's an enemy of the state, and he's arrested, and he's imprisoned in a fortress in a little island right in or outside St. Petersburg, and he spends about 2 months in prison. We're going to circle back to this. We're going to circle back to this in a second, because his time there and the material that he produced while in prison is actually quite important. And as a spoiler alert, the day of his release from prison in 1798 is the 19th of Kislev, and that is the anniversary that all Chabad Hasidim celebrate today, the Yom HaGe'ulah, the day on which the first Lubavitcher Rebbe was released, was redeemed from his imprisonment at the hands of his enemies in 1798. In 1801, Reb Shneur Zalman is arrested and imprisoned again, this time following a denunciation by a man called Rav Avigdor Ben Chaim, who probably out of other reasons to or other valid accusations came up with the notion that in fact Shneur Zalman was a Sabadian, a follower of the false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. About a month later, he was released from prison, but he stayed in St. Petersburg for some period of time. Just to round things out, during the Napoleonic Wars, Shneur Zalman actually supported the Russian Empire. And in the words of Immanuel Etkes, he feared that if Russia were conquered by the French, the Jews would be granted emancipation. He was not in favor of emancipation. The Jews would be granted emancipation, and their connection with tradition would be weakened. With the advance of the French, Shneur Zalman and his family fled from the Pale of Settlement. At some point in 1812, he fell ill, and he died and was buried in Chaditz in the province of Poltava. After his death, just as a kind of brief epilogue, as always, the dispute broke out among some of his followers as to who would be the heir to his legacy. Dov Ber, his eldest son and his principal disciple, won the day, and the Chabad Hasidic dynasty has remained in the family ever since. Seven Lubavitcher Rebbes until the death of the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. That is the history of the rabbinic lineage, beginning with the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman in Liadi. One of his younger sons actually converted to Christianity. They think that he suffered from some kind of mental instability. Okay, Reb Shneur Zalman wrote a number of works. The two principal ones were the Tanya which is studied on a daily basis by Chabad Hasidim around the world. That's not our topic for tonight. And the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which is going to be our topic for tonight, and we're going to come to the Shulchan Aruch in a minute. Emmanuel Etkes sort of breaks down, as a kind of summary, breaks down the debates and the disputes of Reb Shneur Zalman's life into four conflicts. One was a battle he had to wage to reassure internally his own Hasidim that his way was correct. And as I mentioned, you know, he held the Gaon responsible for the conflict and explained that the Vilna Gaon had really been misled. Number two, he had to wage this ongoing battle against the Misnagdim. He was a scholar of the first order, a massive, massive Talmud Chacham. And as we'll see soon, part of his agenda was to promote this idea that in fact he was not a sectarian, but that his arguments and his positions were grounded deeply in the traditional halachic process. Number three, he waged this battle against Russian authorities, and in a certain way became a kind of Jewish icon, because he was asked to speak not just on behalf of Hasidim, but really on behalf of all Jews. And finally, there was this internecine dispute with Reb Abraham of Kalisk, which you know is a footnote for another time. Okay, let me pause here and just ask if there are any questions about Reb Shneur Zalman's biography, and then I want to spend kind of the next few minutes looking with you at really just a series of such fascinating material, where we have his materials from the time that he was imprisoned in St. Petersburg in 1798. So, questions or comments?
Rabbi Levine.
Yes.
Two things. First, what I call it, are you going to discuss at all, or you think it's not relevant, Dr. Berger's criticism of the Lubavitcher movement? And the second thing is, are you going to discuss why the Lubavitcher Hasidim did not sell all the other Hasidim in the Hasidic movement, which was many and many great rebbes of the Hasidic movement?
Tell me about
Lubavitcher, different than other Hasidic movements.
So, I mean, your second question is why Lubavitch didn't?
Correct.
Meaning, just fill in the blank, why they didn't?
Why were they accepted by Satmar and Boviv and Bian and Rizhin and all the other Hasidic movements? They are not, they were never accepted.
Okay. So two excellent questions. I can refer you to my teacher's book, Dr. David Berger, Professor David Berger.
I know he's your teacher.
Who wrote a book called The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. But tonight I really want to focus on the first Lubavitcher Rebbe as opposed to the seventh. Although at the end, time permitting, I do want to circle back and think about the resonances between the first Lubavitcher Rebbe and his teachings that we're going to talk about in a minute, and our contemporary moment and what Chabad means in 2022. Yeah, Garth or Esther?
Stay out of this debate completely, like it wasn't their thing. And then, is the Hasidic Nusach like in any way related to what would have been kind of like the average Sephardic Nusach of the day?
So it's a great question. We may have a minute to talk about it, but the short answer is that the Hasidic Nusach is called colloquially Nusach Sfarad, even though it has very little to do with, you know, Edut HaMizrach and Sephardic Judaism or Sephardic practice. What separates or differentiates the Nusach of the Hasidic Siddur, which is either Nusach Sfarad or Nusach Ari, is really the inclusion of mystical material. And we'll talk about that in a second. Yeah, Alan?
Yeah, so the Misnagdim, in the Vilna Gaon, their take on the Ari and Kabbalah and that whole mysticism that you just were talking about, I would imagine they were versed in this.
Yes, the Vilna Gaon was a Kabbalist. He knew Kabbalah like the back of his hand. It was, you know, and again, as we'll see in a second, part of the objection was not to the study of Kabbalah, but to the popularization of Kabbalah. So if you're a Kabbalist and you're initiated and you're trained, by all means, right? This is holy material, and you should grow from it and learn it and digest it. But the objections come not to the content of the material itself, but rather to the way it's transmitted, how it's transmitted, to whom it's transmitted, and so on. So the material that I want to share with you now comes from the time that Shneur Zalman of Liadeh was in prison in St. Petersburg in 1798. And it's just, it's such extraordinary and fascinating material because we have the transcripts of the interview, right? The Russian authorities are asking the questions and Shneur Zalman is answering them. We have the transcripts, okay? And then in addition, we have the document that Reb Shneur Zalman writes as a response to the Russian authorities, right? They basically say, we have these 22 critiques or questions or criticisms. How do you respond to them? And again, it's not the Gulag. They're not the KGB. They're not torturing him. They actually want to know, and they want to be able to go back to the you know, their higher ups and say, we asked all the right questions and we're satisfied with the answers, which is sort of what happened. But the material that he writes is so telling because it tells us everything that that was being asked or being questioned about this new movement. So I want to just share with you a couple of excerpts. And again, there's so much here. And I'd be happy to, you know, study it with you in depth at you know, another time. But just in the interest of time, I want to share with you just a couple of excerpts. Okay, so start with source number two, which goes on your source sheets. It's just an excerpt to give you a sense of the interrogation, the back and forth. So the she'ela. Okay, so they asked him, ma mikora shel kasu. So they say, you know, tell us what's the nature of this new sect. Kat is a very important word. Chaf tuf. This new sect, this Hasidism. We haven't seen this before. The Jewish community was always the Jewish community with a capital T and traditional. So now we see there's something going on here, and there's a rift, and there's this new sect. So what is it? Who's the leadership? Who are the followers? And who's in charge? Tshuva, and he says, no. Lo haisa v'lo nivra shum kas chadasha. There is nothing new happening here. V'yesh rak pirushim shanim l'kitvei HaKodesh. There's just some different explanations about our holy writings. Kol rav l'fi midas adikaso be'alacha. You know, everyone follows their teacher with respect to how to understand halacha. Behem lo arer dvekus ulei tivos lechukei hakodesh ukufi shelifnei meoshanim pirshu chachamim es dvar elokim ach ein hu yachol limnos es kulam hu atzmo rachash es hasiflaso beemtzaus ha-sifarim. He says, you know, this has been going on for hundreds of years. You know, rabbis give explanations for the holy texts, and sometimes they reach different conclusions. So he says that's the only thing that's happening here. There's nothing new. Now, if you just continue, he makes a scathing allegation. He says, you know, haminhag haya b'chol Yisrael mimei olam lios b'chol ir ve'ir beis batim gedolim letzvila beis kenesus ubeis hamedrash. There were always two houses of worship in the Jewish community, a base kinesis and a base medrash, what we call a shul and a base medrash or school. Base kinesis lahamun am hatrudim biskem kol hayom v'ruba mein yodei sefer klal. He says, you know, the shul is for people who have to run to work and they don't have a lot of time. They're very busy. They're not studying. Ubeis medrash liyodei sefer lispal sham bekavanas alev baruchus ish kifi yicholas sichlo v'libo. And in the base medrash, you have people who are more learned and they have more time and they could daven, you know, with more kavan. V'nei basrim shekasvu chachamim shifnei masayim shana me'ayom if rasham eich she as hayu me'arichus batvilo plus a shachar b'chol yam v'yam erach beis shaus v'yosir mechach masarichus kabanas shabalev. People used to take a long time, and they'd come an hour early, and they'd prepare themselves. Ach achar kach, he says, the problem is, amdu etzlenu rabbanim she'enam hagunim. We had, over the past 200 years, rabbis who became communal leaders who were totally unqualified and ill-equipped. And this is an amazing allegation. There's a lot of truth to it. He says, v'kanu es sichro harabanus misarayir besach misiyam. They just bought the post. There's somebody in charge of the, you know, the region on a state level who was in charge of rabbinic posts, and you give the guy a bribe, and you become the rabbi. B'chol year v'year, b'chol malchus Poland. He says, that's what happened, the whole Polish history. Ki ha-melech ha-elim ayin, the, you know, the government turned a blind eye, v'asirim ba'ad, betz ha-kesef nasin b'chtav nikra, kaznish la-raf, she-b'chol year li-os moshel ha-kol ha-yehudim, she-b'iro, b'chol inan ha-nugel ha-datam. He says, they gave it away for a bribe. And he continues, he says, and these rabbis, they blew it, because they created environments where davening was just racing through the tefillah and nobody paid any attention. And my main goal is just to restore things to the way they ought to be, where people actually think about and care about davening. So allegation number one, we're not going to cover all of them, but are you a sectarian? Is this all new? No, no, no. This is not new at all. Allegation number two, you know, it seems that you know they're doing something different about davening. Is that true? He says, no, it's not true at all. We're just trying to return things to the way they were, because you know, now that the Russians are in charge, things are much better. But when the Poles were in charge, what a disaster it was under the leadership of these unqualified, on these people who, you know, are unqualified to be rabbis. Okay. In the interest of time, I'll just summarize, you know, what he says in the next paragraphs. So they asked him, you know, it seems to be that there's this a Rebbe who gets worshipped, and he becomes this leader, and everyone follows him. Isn't, you know, what's that about? And he says, no, that's an old thing. There was always a magid. There was always a preacher who inspired people with their sermons and with their lectures, and people gathered around. And he says, you know, a Rebbe is just, it's like a magid. And this is slightly disingenuous, because there's a principal difference between a Rebbe and a magid. But it, once again, you think this is all new. No, well, this is just an old, this is just an old a practice. The next in paragraph Tezayin, if you're following in your source sheet, so this circles back to what a couple of you have asked, and he has to justify. He says, you know, you accuse us of publicizing Kabbalah, okay? and that was a major accusation against the Baal HaTanya, because right, this became a Kabbalistic work for the layperson. And he says, no, I'm not telling them anything they don't already know. These Kabbalistic books have been in print for years, and they're all accessible to the public. And I'm not doing anything here that's not been done before. Finally, and again, just in the interest of time, there are many more, but one of the most scathing allegations, and this stuck with the Hasidim for hundreds of years, was the allegation that the Rebbes were on the take. That people were coming in and making all sorts of gifts, and the Rebbes were taking these, you know, kind of indulgences. He says, no, we never charged for anything. We never asked anyone to bring anything. There were allegations that young people were stealing from their parents so they could bring gifts to the Rebbe and to the Hasidic court. He says, no, lo haya v'lo nivra, never happened, was never a thing. If someone comes and they have a wonderful experience, they want to make a donation to the Hasidic court, so we're not stopping them. But he says, we never did anything. We never did anything untoward. We certainly never took any money that we weren't supposed to take. So this is the background. I want to turn now to the Shulchan Aruch Harav, but it's against this this backdrop that I want to introduce this this book to you. The backdrop being that we have here in the person of Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the principal defender of Hasidus and the principal defender against all these accusations which are coming either directly from the Misnagdim or from the Misnagdim vis-a-vis the Russian government to whom they had informed on Reb Shneur Zalman, right? Everything that they could possibly find wrong with this new movement, right? They piled on, and Reb Shneur Zalman has to answer these questions. So I'll just share with you the introduction. This is source number three, and again, in the interest of time, I'll mostly summarize it. Reb Shneur Zalman never wrote an introduction to his Shulchan Aruch Harav. Here's a copy of a 19th century edition. But his sons wrote an introduction to the Shulchan Aruch Harav. And they explain in the introduction that at some point when he was still a young man, Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich, who you remember was the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov, Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich got a hold of Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and he said, I need someone to present the Shulchan Aruch in such a way that will be accessible and meaningful to our people in this moment. He says, you know, people are suffering, people are very busy, people don't have the wherewithal to open up the Shulchan Aruch and learn it and know it. So I need someone who's going to rework this this book in a language, in a tone that will be for our moment. And he taps Reb Shneur Zalman to do this. So, and this is amazing, right? Reb Shneur Zalman basically sets out to rewrite the Shulchan Aruch 200 years after it had been published. And he writes a commentary, not really a commentary, but he rewrites the text to Orach Chaim and to Yoredeya. We mostly have Orach Chaim. It's not on all of Orach Chaim. We have most of his text Orach Chaim, a lot of Yoredeya. We no longer have. What's this text? What's the book? So part of what you would want to know about the Shulchan Aruch Harav is that it's exceptionally clear. The Shulchan Aruch Harav gives you all kinds of context and background that you wouldn't have if you were just reading a Shulchan Aruch. He constantly quotes the original sources going all the way back to Tanakh. I just did a quick count. The word Shenemar appears in the Shulchan Aruch maybe 20 times in Orach Chaim, in the Shulchan Aruch Harav, in Reb Shneur Zalman Liadi's updated version, hundreds of times. He wants you to know where things come from. Reb Shlomo Zevin, who actually wrote one of the only academic articles about the Shulchan Aruch Harav, has a theory. I'm not sure it always bears out, but his theory is that the Shulchan Aruch, Reb Yosef Karo was interested in practice. Here's a practical guide. You want to know the halacha? Open my book. I'll tell you what to do. And Reb Shneur Zalman was interested in expanding Jewish knowledge. So not just to tell you what to do, but to tell you why you do it and how you do it and where it comes from and what it's about. And if we have time, I'll show you an example or two. He relies heavily on the Magen Avraham, who we learned about in the last session. And it's not coincidental that the Magen Avraham relied heavily on the Zohar in his commentary. So the Shulchan Aruch Harav is also introducing a mystical element, a mystical component to an otherwise non-mystical book. So the question is, right? What is the nature of this book? Okay, so let me just show you a couple quick examples, so you get a sense of what it is that we're talking about, not just in an abstract way, but in a concrete way. And what I've done for you in the sources is I've paired a source from the Shulchan Aruch with the kind of matching source from the Shulchan Aruch Harav. So a quick example. And again, we've been learning Hilchos Chanukah, but there is no Hilchos Chanukah in the Shulchan Aruch Harav, so a couple excerpts from Hilchos Tefillah. The Shulchan Aruch writes, Yishtadel Adam Lispalo Bebeis HaKnesses Im HaTzibur. A person should always try to daven with a minion in shul. Right? And if he's not able to get to shul, he should at least daven at the same time that the shul is davening. And again, just you could see it here. The Shulchan Aruch has one line. The Shulchan Aruch Harav has 20 lines. Now listen, again, he's not plagiarizing. It's all based on the Shulchan Aruch. He's giving you the same information, but listen to what he does with it. Word for word. The person should try to daven with the minyan. Even if you could get a minyan in your house, better to go to shul where there's more people. And you know something? Really only the tefillah of a beis kneses, those are the words of tefillah that get heard. Why? Shenamar, he's not making this up. This is a Gemara. He says, I'll give you the pasuk. Lishmoa el harina v'el hatfila. And it's actually right, we have a whole slicha about this on the first night of slichos, lishmoa el harina v'el hatfila. So the pasuk says, lishmoa el harina v'el hatfila. And the Gemara says, what's the taich? B'makom rina sham tehei tfila. Where you have the singing and you have the song and you have the tzibur, that's where the tefillah should be. So he transformed a pretty anodyne halacha into something with context and feeling. And like, now you know what? The Shulchan Aruch says, go to shul, daven with the minyan, be a good Jew. And the Shulchan Aruch Harav says, you should daven with the minyan. You should be a good Jew. You should go to shul. That's where we sing. That's where there's a group of people. That's where your tefillah gets. Gets heard. Okay. Two more quick examples. Shulchan Aruch writes in source number 6. Yachol yisbal b'chol lashon shiyirtzeh v'hani mili b'tzibur aval biyachol lo yisbal l'ol b'lashon hakodesh. You could daven any language that you want as long as you're with the minyan. If you're by yourself, you should daven in Hebrew. Shulchan Aruch Harav says, "Yachol yisbal b'chol lashon shiyirtzeh kin yisbal b'tzibur, aval biyachid lo yisbal l'ol b'lashon hakodesh." When you daven by yourself, you have to daven in Hebrew. Why? Shulchan Aruch didn't tell you. The Shulchan Aruch says, "I'll tell you why." Because the angels don't understand other languages. Lo yimas, when you daven with the tzibur, your tefillah goes right to Hashem. But when you daven by yourself, there's an intercessor, there's a malach, there's an angel in between. And guess what? According to the Kabbalistic sources, the malachim don't understand other languages. They only know Hebrew, so you have to daven in Hebrew when you daven by yourself. So now you have the context and the background and the resources and the Kabbalah. I'll just summarize the next source for you. This is actually going to be very, very important. Source number 8, the Shulchan Aruch says, you know, there's some debate as to whether or not you put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Because on the one hand, regular Chol, on a weekday, you put on tefillin. But on Shabbos and Yontif, you don't put on tefillin. Because the day itself is considered an os, so you don't need the os, you don't need the sign of the tefillin. So Chol HaMoed, well, is it Shabbos? Meaning, is it Yontif rather, or is it Chol? It's Chol HaMoed. It has this dual identity. So you could kind of hear both. You kind of hear both sides. So the Shulchan Aruch writes. That what should you do? According to the Sfardim, you don't put on tefillin, and then. And then in Sif Beis, v'chein noagim b'chol glilos elo laniach b'moed. This is the Rama, right? What we do in Ashkenazic lands is we put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Okay, and this was kind of a divide between the Sfardim and the Ashkenaz. So what is the Shulchan Aruch Harav saying? So the Shulchan Aruch Harav, I just quoted you from the Shulchan Aruch Harav. Who echoes the sentiment of the Rama and says, right, Chassidim, you readers of my book, you should put on tefillin. If you ever met a Chassid, or specifically a Chabad Chassid, you can be sure they are not putting on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Okay, and you can go over to them and you could show them the Shulchan Aruch Harav and say, here it is, black on white, source number 9 on Levine's source sheet. The Shulchan Aruch Harav wrote that you put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So what are you doing? And what will the Chassid answer you? Or what will the Chabadnik answer you? We'll say that's just what it says in the Shulchan Aruch Haran. But you have to know the Siddur. Everyone knows that the author of the Shulchan Aruch Harav also wrote a commentary to the Siddur. And whenever there's a debate between the Siddur and the Shulchan Aruch Harav, we always follow the Siddur. And in the Siddur, he tells you not to put on tefillin. In source number 11, you can see the introduction to the Siddur. Avram Chaim Na'eh writes about all these discrepancies between the Shulchan Aruch Harav and the Siddur, and concludes by telling us, no, in the end, you always follow the Siddur. Okay. So, I bring this out to make the following point. Why did Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi write the Shulchan Aruch Harav? He wrote it because Reb Dov Ber Mezrich asked him to write it, but he wrote it so that his opponents would know or would believe that the followers of Hasidism were traditional Jews. So you think we're deviant and we're sectarian and we do things differently. Read my book. You'll see that we're totally traditional, including in areas where you think that, well, you see, we don't put on tefillin. No, right. We do exactly what you do. Here it is. And then kind of, you know, on the side, you know, the Torah Shebal Peh and the Siddur, if you really want to know, right, what you tell the Hasidim is, we don't do that. Hasidim have a different take. We don't put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. The Shulchan Aruch Harav was an attempt to show the traditional world that Hasidism should be taken seriously in the world of Talmud Torah. Reb Shneur Zalman was the best person to do that because he was a massive Talmud Chacham and he knew all the sources backwards and forwards. And he wrote a traditional book rather than justify any questionable practices. He didn't say, oh, you know, we don't put on tefillin, I'll explain to you. He could have done that and he would have had plenty of sources to do it because he knew them all. He didn't do that. The book preached traditional Judaism. I'll conclude with two final points. One is an excerpt from the summary of Emmanuel Etkes, who writes so beautifully, even though it's in translation. He says, Reb Shneur Zalman's rise to leadership happened by chance. Not only did he not attain that position by virtue of his ancestry, but he did not even desire it. Even after he was called on to fill the void that was created in the leadership of the Hasidim of White Russia, after Reb Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk and Reb Abraham of Kalis went to live in the land of Israel, he was reluctant and refused. Only after these leaders kept insisting did he overcome his hesitations and accede to their request. Within a few years, Shneur Zalman had proved that he stood head and shoulders above the other Hasidic leaders of his time. Indeed, he possessed a combination of virtues. He was a rabbinic scholar, a deep and original thinker, and a talented preacher, educator, and administrator. In addition, he had a deep sense of mission, firm confidence in the rightness of Hasidism, and great sensitivity to the needs of the Jews in the Russian Empire. Moreover, he possessed courage, authority, determination, and self-control. Hence, it is no wonder that Shneur Zalman can be seen as a charismatic leader in the full sense of the word. Like other Hasidic courts, Shneur Zalman's also served as a center for conversion to Hasidism. However, in this matter, Shneur Zalman acted in his own unique fashion. The institution of Yechidus, personal interviews, took on the character of an intimate and deep encounter of the Rebbe with the Hasid in an effort to offer him the spiritual direction that suited his personality and needs. The public sermon became an exhilarating experience, in part because it was grasped as an event in which the secrets of the Torah were revealed. The sermons were written down, copied by the Hasidim, and studied. The Tanya became a guide in the service of God, and those who visited the court were invited to take part in lessons on the Tanya and the words of Hasidism. The increase in the numbers of Hasidim drawn to Shneur Zalman's court during the 1790s confronted him with a difficult dilemma. Should he devote most of his time and energy to fostering the connection with his veteran Hasidim, or was it preferable to attract new Hasidim? Shneur Zalman chose the latter alternative. I'll conclude with one final thought. Okay. Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi was an extraordinary man who wielded enormous influence both in his lifetime and after his lifetime. Today, there's certainly not the same emphasis on erudition or scholarship in Chabad like there once was, even though there is this tradition to study the Tanya. But it struck me that at least three of the major aspects of Rav Schneur Zalman's life continue to animate the movement. And again, I'm not a scholar of Chabad, but number one, there's a continued emphasis on proselytizing, right? There's missionaries who are sent all over the world to bring people in under the umbrella of Chabad Hasidism. There's a continued sense of this us-them mentality that separates adherents from would-be adherents, right? We are different. And finally, there's an abiding desire to gloss over those differences between traditional Judaism and Chabad Hasidism, a desire to be seen and treated as normative. Look at my Shulchan Aruch Harav. I'm not doing anything different. This is totally normative. Everything is just the way it should be. Since the 16th century, some of the greatest rabbinic minds hitched their wagons to Rabbi Yosef Karo and wrote commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, but there's only one person that I know of, only one person who quite literally rewrote the book. Okay, the Vilna Gaon and his followers considered Hasidim to be sectarians. It was the sectarians who considered themselves to be traditional. I'm going to pause here and stay on. I'm happy to take questions or comments, but I'm just going to stop the video so it doesn't go on and on.